Tonight on Arena, Black Widow, First Cow, Tove and Martin Eden are the movies up for review, and Colm McAnamara gives us live music in a Studio 8 session. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. And movie reviews first this evening. A latest offering from the Marvel Cinematic Universe. An interquel we will be talking about. It's called Black Widow. Stars Scarlett Johansson in the title role and Florence Pugh as her, in inverted commas, sister. First Cow is a Kelly Reichardt-directed drama set in 1820 in the Pacific Northwest of the United States. Two travellers dream of striking it rich. Our third film is Martin Eden, an Italian adaptation of a 1909 novel by Jack London. And finally, from Finland, Tove, a biographical film focusing on the life and author of illustrator Tove Jansson, who we spoke about earlier in the week here on the programme. Tara Brady, Daryl Jones have been watching the four films for us, and they join me now. We'll start with Black Widow. Scarlett Johansson here as Natasha Romanoff, also known as Black Widow in her superhero mode, the American superhero based on the Marvel character of the same name. 24th film in the Marvel Cinematic Universe series, directed by Kate Shortland. And as well as Scarlett Johansson, we have Florence Pugh, William Hurt, Ray Winston, Rachel Weisz. Quite a cast there. Tara, I love this word, interquel. Please don't try to explain the entire Marvel Universe to me, but just give us a rough, what do we need to know about where this interquel, between what does it happen?
So an interquel is a way for a franchise to bring back characters that, to not be spoilery, are maybe no longer with the franchise. So it's a very handy trick, and we've seen it in the Star Wars universe a few times. Rogue One is one, and Solo is another one. And it's not to be confused with a midquel, which is a film which happens in the middle of another film in the franchise. But Black Widow takes place immediately after Captain America: Civil War, which, if you remember, is the one where they were all squabbling, I think would be the most succinct way of putting it.
And then after the event, they're kind of all back to, after this film, if you like, they're all back together. Some of them are back together, working on the next stage of battling the battle between good and evil. And that's as much as I need to know. Basically, they were all squabbling before this, and now they've stopped squabbling. But we have two sisters here at the heart of the film, Daryl.
We do, or sort of sisters, at least. Yeah, this is Scarlett Johansson and Florence Pugh. So the interquel. Holy moly, I'm learning new words tonight. So we begin in suburban Ohio in the 90s, in 95, with what will be a familiar scenario for many watchers of television: a pair of Russian sleeper agents. You know, this is David Harbour and Rachel Weisz, and their two apparent daughters who have to make a very quick escape because the authorities are coming to get them. And then the two girls are trained in the Red Room, which is some sort of shadowy organization of superhuman super agents run by the evil Ray Winston, they go their separate ways, Natasha and her younger sister, Yelena, with all kinds of unresolved issues about families. But then the film reunites them.
Yeah, I suppose, again, we're down to, you can get bogged down in all the detail here. Basically, the two sisters are back together. Could we say, Tara, that perhaps there are two women at the front of this 24th movie in the Marvel Cinematic Universe franchise?
Oh, well, I think that's definitely fair to say, and very much the entire purpose of the film. And this has become a real trend on Disney, as we've seen with Loki and the spin-off TV series, because of course, suddenly now there's a Disney Plus streaming service, and that's a very valuable asset. It's very clearly set up to spawn either a film sequel or to allow for some kind of Red Room spin-off TV series of female assassins. It allows for many Black Widows rather than just one. I think where this film is very like a general Marvel film is that sort of use of humour and that sort of putting superheroes in everyday human situations. And I think that's where the film is at its best, is when you get
that
sort of the kind of family, the superhero family squabbling at the dinner table.
Right. Well, let's get a clip that gives us that type of thing. Not quite squabbling at the dinner table, but taking out their costumes from previous years and times. David Harbour is Alexi here, delighted with himself when he's putting on his suit. Scarlett Johansson as Natasha, Florence Pugh as Yelena, and Rachel Weisz as Melina. That's, I suppose, mother and two daughters, in inverted commas, are watching on and making comments as he's delighted with himself.
It still fades.
Oh, my God. I never washed it once. Come and drink.
Rise, you workers of salvation. Family. Back together again.
Seeing as our family construct was just a calculated ruse that only lasted 3 years, I don't think that we can use this term anymore, can we?
Agreed. So here's what's going to happen.
Okay, reunion then, huh? And, I want to say something right off the bat. You haven't aged a day.
You're just as beautiful and as supple as the day they staged our marriage.
You got fat, but still good.
I suppose that is the fun of it, is it? David Harbour there, getting all the best lines, it has to be said, more or less. Scarlett Johansson, Florence Pugh and Rachel Weisz also in the mix there with the putting on of the old suits. There's the humour. And I guess the other bit is, Daryl, is it a case of turn off your mind and just enjoy the action? Is there enough of that going on?
There's plenty of action. It strikes me that you know, it's a long film, actually.
Yeah, two hours.
2.25 hours, yeah. And Marvel Cinematic Universe films are often very long films. And, you know, it's okay, I guess, because you know there's going to be something exciting coming along any minute now. We've got fighty Florence Pugh, and we've got Scarlett Johansson, and they fight each other, they fight everybody else. The action is well staged. There's a really splendid jailbreak sequence in a Russian prison in which David Harbour is broken out of jail. You know, there are scenes that remind you of an international espionage movie, you know, motorbike chases through Budapest, that sort of thing. So it's not as though there isn't plenty going on.
Yeah, but so what you're saying is suggesting me is you want a new type of quell, which is a short quell. You're looking for one of those, or an under 2 hour quell.
Definitely.
Does it work overall for, or did it work overall for you, Tara? And what are you saying in terms of stars for Black Widow, the interquell? It's my favourite word of the week, I have to say.
it certainly passed the time. I think Marvel films are at their best when they have something else going on. Like for example, like Ant-Man is a heist movie, or Winter Soldier is one of those kind of paranoid thrillers. I think partly this one has an idea that it wants to be Moonraker, which you see actually earlier in the film. But I think it sort of loses its way. If you look at, for example, of the scene with Ray Winston where he's hitting someone, he's not moustache twirling and cartoonish enough to be a sort of James Bond nemesis of that era. And I think it would have been better if it had kind of stuck with that idea, because it's a very fun idea to have done a Black Widow Moonraker. I think that would have been a better film.
And stars, Tom?
Three.
Three from you. I think you're in accord on the Ray Winston not quite being villainous enough, Daryl, as you give me your stars.
I think it's an unusual thing, a bad performance from Ray Winston, who is not, you know, a shadowy Soviet era deep state power broker. He's a Cockney gangster. That's what it is. So he's Ray Winston, of course he is. And I find it interesting that what we look for in these massive cinematic extravaganzas of the Marvel Cinematic Universe are things that remind us of small films. You know, family dialogue, witty banter. Okay. These kinds of things. It seems to be missing the point. So, yeah, 3 stars for me as well.
3 stars in accord, the both of you then, on Black Widow. Let's move on to First Cow, directed by Kelly Reichardt, adapted from the novel The Half Line by John Raymond. Script by Reichardt and Raymond, off-time collaborators in terms of script writing. We're in the Pacific Northwest of the early 19th century, and friendship is really at the heart of this. Even the start of this movie, Daryl, it takes its time getting to tell us where we're even going to be in terms of history, in terms of location.
That is the really startling thing about this film for me. It's not a very long film. It's shorter than Black Widow, but my word, this is a slow film. And this is a feature of the film. I'm not being hostile or critical of it here. It's just that you need to get in to the leisurely sort of pace and groove of this film. So we start in modern day Oregon, where a young woman, it's Alia Shawkat, in fact, discovers while walking her dog, discovers human remains. She discovers a pair of skeletons lying side by side. And so obviously the question is, who are these people? How did they get there? And then we cut back to the 19th century with some long introductory scenes in which we meet Cookie, one of our protagonists, played by John McGarrah, who is this kind of gentle soul who works as a cook for a group of rough-edged fur trappers, and he meets in the woods a Chinese man, King Lu, played by played by Orion Lee, who's on the run, and a friendship develops between these two men very slowly.
It develops very, very slowly, Tara, and it does take its time, because that's the kind of the heart of the movie, is that friendship, really, and the relationship that grows between the two men. But it takes a long time to get there. And is it delicate in how it explores the friendship and the relationship then?
I think so. I mean, this is very typical of Kelly Reichardt's pacing, it must be said. All of her films are very much about leaving you with space to think things through for yourself or to contemplate things. And if you weren't won over by, Meek's Cutoffs or one of her earlier films, this probably won't do the trick. Male friendship is something she's explored before with a terrific film a number of years ago, Old Joy, starring the musician Will Oldham, and it's something she's very, very good on, and I think what's great about her is she sort of sees it, and there's no homoerotic overtones or undertones or anything like that here. It's literally about the way that friendship can be like a romance, that two people can just kind of strike up and immediately get each other, and there's this immediate sense of trust between the two men, even though they're very different characters, It's a really lovely, kind of sensitive sort of relationship, and it's very, very unusual one to see on the screen, because most male friendships that we see, certainly in Hollywood films, are, very, very, very much about, they're very bromance, and, they're backslapping and they're all that sort of thing. So this is very, very unusual to see.
Yeah.
But it's also very intelligently and delicately handled all the way through.
And so, I mean, the first cow of the title is that this first cow is brought into the region. Basically, these are pioneers. They really are breaking new ground, although there were people on those lands beforehand, guys. In case you think history only starts with you, but this first cow coming into the region is at the heart of it. And the friendship, they're kind of, I suppose, in the 21st century, this would be called brainstorming. They're sitting around having supper one night when they start to talk about this first cow, and they're beginning to think, there might be something we could do here. Let's listen.
What else do you need to make good biscuits, Cookie?
Flour. Some sugar, salt, baking soda.
How long does it take to milk a cow?
Not long.
Make much noise?
No.
Can cows give milk at night?
As long as she wasn't milked after dinner.
There you go. We're only heading one direction there. I mean, cows be milking now. John McGarrow as Cookie, Orion Lee as King Lou, the two pals in the film we're speaking about. First cow. And Daryl, effectively, Cookie makes amazing biscuits or scones, whatever you want to call them. And that becomes their kind of little venture, and they need milk to do so. Where does Toby Jones fit into all of this?
So Toby Jones is the chief factor. He's the local bigwig, the local sort of successful businessman, the plutocrat, and he owns the cow. This is, as you say, the first cow in the territory, and it's a major status symbol. That's what it is. He's very proud of his cow and the difficulty of getting this European cow way out west there. You know. Yes, that they are. In order to, it's a very American story, you know, of immigrant entrepreneurs, in order to make their delicious biscuits, they steal the milk from the local bigwig's cow.
Well, you've both mentioned, Tara, at this stage, the pacing that Reichardt gives us here. It's important to talk about how the film looks as well, I think.
Yeah, no, it's a fantastic looking film, and it's a regular cinematographer who's always and also, it must be said, fantastic sound design too. I mean, there's a very, very tactile feel, like as you're walking along a forest floor, you can really feel, you know, every crunch, and you can feel the sort of damp underfoot as you do so. Really, really great use of kind of muted colors, and again, that gives you that classic Reichardt thing of like space to think, and she doesn't really assault you with what the film's about. I mean, there's nobody there talking about colonization or class structure or any of those things, but we do see Native Americans serving in the big house, and we do see the inequality of the land of opportunity in the figure of the cow and the ownership of the cow. And we do also kind of learn a lot about the nature of kind of the colonization imperialist project through kind of little throwaway things like the fact that Toby Jones is there having this throwaway conversation about fashions in Paris, and that's what's preoccupying him. And also that chilling moment where he has the mathematical calculation about, well, you know, it's better to kind of flog a man half to death because it'll be a lesson to the others, and therefore you'll get more labor out of the others if you've made an example out of one, even though you'll get no more work out of him.
So
there's lots of little things that are left there, and then you get this beautiful scene in which to think about them.
Yeah, stars from you, Tara, as I go to Daryl. Stars, Tara?
4.5.
4.5 from Tara. I think you need decent equipment to watch this, otherwise it is very shady and dark, but that's the nature of the cinematography, which we, on proper equipment, you'll see absolutely perfectly well. A summary from you, Daryl, did you enjoy this? Was it too slow, in fact, and stars?
It was in the end, you know, I appreciate what the film is trying to do. And it is a damp, it's a muddy, it's an atmospheric film. It's a film in which almost everybody has a spectacular facial hair. It's one of those kinds of films, you know. But of course I enjoyed it very much. 4.5 from me as well.
A fairly solid, well, I think more than a solid 4.5 from both of you there in the case of First Cow. Moving on then to Martin Eden. We're in America, you would think. We certainly are in the Jack London novel written in 1909, focusing on a young working class man struggling to become a writer. But we're shifting location here. Quite an unusual shift of location, it would have to be said. But first of all, maybe give us a sense of the status of the novel, Tara.
Well, if you remember, a few months ago, I was on singing the praises of Jack London. He's one of my favourite novelists, and this is my favourite novel of his, and maybe certainly one of my top five novels of all time. So, you know, you approach it when someone's adapting a book that's one of your top five novels of all time, you tend to be a little bit nervous about it. But this gets it absolutely right. It transports it. It makes it into its own thing, and it preserves the kind of heart of the story. And the original story is about a young man, a young sailor, who rescues a nobleman when the nobleman is set upon by ruffians, and the nobleman sort of brings him back almost half as a bet to meet his family, and the young sailor falls for the nobleman's sister and sets about improving himself and teaching himself and making himself a better person in order to be worthy of her. And there's a huge amount of autobiographic material in the actual novel. Certainly one of the most autobiographical books that London wrote. But what's different about Martin Eden is that whereas London was a committed socialist, was very concerned about poverty and about the union rights and labour and all of those things, Martin Eden is not. And because he instead embraces a very individualistic ideology, his life ultimately becomes like this ongoing act of bad faith. And so that the new setting of Naples in the 1920s is absolutely perfect because it has these kind of overtones of the birth of fascism and Mussolini. There's an obvious overlap there. Let me actually use some archive footage to illustrate that.
Yeah, there's a lot of archive footage in there. I'll come back to that. But let me go to Daryl on that shift to Naples and 1920. I don't think it was as straightforward as that for you, Daryl, was it?
No, it wasn't. And this is, for me, this is the most interesting thing about the film, is its disorientation, its dislocation. In the novel, we're in California. Here we are, I think, in Naples. But sometimes we're in 1909 when the novel was made, and there's grainy, black and white footage from that period. Sometimes in the wealthy Orsini's home, we do seem to be in some kind of Edwardian period. But the Orsini's drive a 1990s Volvo. And sometimes we're in the 1950s or 1960s, and it looks like Italian neorealist cinema. And the film stock used is different at various points as well. So you're never quite sure when you are, let alone where you are.
Director Pietro Marcello, then, is he doing something here with the film, Tara, that reflects something that goes on in the book?
Yeah, I think so. And it's also worth noting that one of the things that we mentioned the last time we were talking about Jack London was that Jack London has a far more enduring reputation in continental Europe, to use that old fashioned phrase, than he does in the kind of Anglophone world. He's still best known or almost entirely known now for the dog books, Call of the Wild and White Fang. But Martin Eden is a huge book in Europe, and it's been remade many times in Italy and Russia and France. You know, it would have been on Le Mans, 100 greatest novels of the 20th century. So it has I think that's part of what they're trying to do with the film, is to emphasize how enduring the novel is and the themes of the novel are and its worth and I think it does that very, very well.
Let me ask you then, Daryl, about performances. Two very important women here, Jessica Cressy as the Orsi, as the noble woman that he falls for, that the writer Luca Marinelli playing the Eden character falls for, and also then Denise Sardisio, who's the Margherita, who's a younger woman in the village that he falls, or in the city that he falls for at one point along the way. How did the performances work for you?
Those two performances were absolutely fine, although they're put to the service of the films, and I guess the books, but certainly the films' political agenda, so that Elena, Jessica Cressy, is made to embody a kind of bourgeois respectability. That's what Martin rejects. The film, I think, is absolutely ensorcelled, that's the word I'm looking for, by its central performance by Martin Eden and Luca Marinelli himself. It can't take its eyes off him. I think we're asked to take him very much at his own evaluation, and I'm afraid I just did not.
So stars, Daryl.
Martin, stop acting like a dick is what one of the characters says at one point, and I felt that all the way through. I think with respect to Tara, I think earnest, bookish 17-year-old boys will love this film, but I didn't. Three stars for me.
You may be bookish, you're not a 17-year-old boy, and if you are, Ernest, it's always in the best possible taste, I would say, in your defence, Tara, but I think you felt very different about this film.
I love this, and I think Luca Marinelli puts in one of the best performances I've seen in like a very, very long time. I mean, it's just completely magnetic. No, I'm very happy to give this 5. I absolutely adored it.
Very definitely. I love when there's a difference of opinion. It always makes for. But now I think people can go off and watch it and see who they believe bet more.
Yeah.
5. And what did you say? Sorry, Daryl.
I said 3.
3. Okay. Let's move on then to Tove, Finland, a biographical film focusing on the life of the author and illustrator Tove Jansson. Or I suppose she was the author of the Moomin's comic strip characters and books, which were hugely successful for her, even though she may have wanted her painting to be more successful for her. But this film, Tara, is focusing on a very specific point in time and aspect of Jansson's life.
Yeah, it's a decade in her life, and she's making the movements, but she has some notion of wanting to be a kind of proper artist, and her father is a famous sculptor and her mother designed postage stamps. So, you know, she has that sort of legacy, weight of legacy behind her. And then there's also, like, you know, sort of two important love affairs. One is with a prominent socialist politician, and the other is with a theatre director who she completely falls for.
The theatre director being a woman and the politician being a man.
Yes, so you have this bisexual triangle set up, and you have a really, really evocative kind of production design and costume design, must be said. And if you look at photos of Jansson's studio at the time, they've recreated it absolutely perfectly. And so it's a fairly conventional biopic, I would say, though, of someone who was a very unconventional person.
That's what I was let me ask Daryl exactly that question, Tara has given us her take on it. You know, this is a very interesting character, very interesting both artistically and in terms of her personal life. You want a very interesting film to follow that. Did you get that, Daryl?
No, I mean, it's a light middlebrow film, I think. I mean, what is really good is Alma Poisty's central performance. It's absolutely, I think, sparkling central performance as Tove herself, which lifts the film, I think. But no, it's not, considering it's a film about, the world of artists and the bohemian world, it is quite a conventional film in that way.
So that sounds like disappointment from you. Were there anything from both of you? In fact, was there anything that kind of merited a big tick in the stars box from you, Tara, as you give us your summary and star rating?
Well, as Daryl said, fantastic central performance, a very, very nice looking film. And I will say, it's lovely to have a real life story set in the 40s and 50s a gay story that doesn't end in some awful tragedy. So that's a very big plus, I would have said. I'm happy to give it sort of 3.5 stars.
Three and a half.
But don't expect the earth to move.
The earth won't move. 3.5 stars. Earth staying still for you, and how many stars? Question and answer, please, Daryl.
The earth stayed more or less so, but I because the central performance is I think so splendid and so captivating, and I think because I watched it back to back with Martin Eden, they're very different kinds of films, but I know which artist I'd rather spend my time with.
Stars.
So four stars for me.
4 stars from Daryl. That's Tove, Martin Eden, First Cow and Black Widow, the 4 films that Daryl Jones and Tara Brady speaking to us about on this Thursday evening. The Carja Sligo Arts Festival takes place this Saturday and Sunday, and one of the star attractions is musician and composer Colm McInerney, who will perform live with Maya Sophia. This will be Colm's first live performance with an actual audience since April of 2020. The gig itself is sold out, but it's still possible to buy a ticket to watch it live streamed this Saturday at 8 p.m. Delighted to have Colm in the RT Radio Studio 8 with us for a session today. Catherine Fitzgerald is here as well to accompany him on piano. This is kind of the first live piece of music that I'll be sitting opposite, which I'm very excited about, Colm. Now, I know this is only an audience of one, but the idea, the prospect of a live gig at the weekend with an audience of more than one. What's the feeling around that?
I suppose mixed levels of anxiety. I think we're all feeling anxious about just meeting friends, regardless of complete strangers. But I seem to be getting calmer as the date draws nearer. So yeah, I should be fine on the day.
And when you say anxiety around strangers, obviously the audience members you're talking about there, are you talking about simple COVID anxiety?
I think it's strange. I mean, just kind of, well, I suppose we live in the countryside, so like interacting in the local town or shopping, you know, or cafes or, you know, I think everybody's a bit jumpy, you know, and even kind of our social skills, conversation skills have been it's like not having heard our own voices for a long time. strange times indeed.
And I guess that's true for audience members as well. There is that kind of level of anxiety, just that it's that up on the level a little bit.
Yeah. And I suppose looking forward to is the musical aspect, which is the BAM, you know, and I think there is something magic about, you know, that when people listen to music together or experience it together, and that you're kind of part of a bigger thing.
Yeah, because you're playing it at home, if you're rehearsing, whatever, you're playing it for yourself in some ways. But when there's somebody out there, there's something else coming back, and the excitement around that will overcome the other anxiety. Because most of the last while has been spent composing.
Yes, I've been working away, really. I haven't, thankfully, I have a setup at home that I can kind of work away on projects, doing different various soundtrack scores and interesting projects, yeah. So
the first piece that we're going to hear in this session is one of the, it's a new piece that you have been working on, Slán na hÉireann. What's the background to this piece?
Well, this is one of the projects on my hub at the moment is setting one of Theo Dorgan's poems about Amargin to music, and it's a commission for the Kilkenny Festival. So I've been working on that, and it was to be for this August, but it's going to be put back until October or something.
So Amargin was the kind of the first Irish language poet, was that?
Well, Amargin was actually, he was a blow-in from, he was a poet of the Milesians who would have come in from Spain, and I think the DNA is all actually, the scientific evidence is kind of filling in a lot of the gaps between myth and history. So it's interesting. So the poem is a conversation between Amargin and the poet, woman poet of the Tuatha-Dé Danann, who are the people in charge of there. And the piece Slán na hÉireann is towards the end. Spoiler alert: the Tuatha-Dé Danann. So she accepts the inevitability of the invasion of the Milesians, and accepts that the Tuatha-Dé Danann are going to move to the underworld. So this is kind of a...
So it's she that's bidding Slán na hÉireann.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And it's kind of the end of an age. Yeah.
Let's have a listen then. Slán na hÉireann, performed there by Colm McInamara and Catherine Fitzgerald on piano. Really atmospheric feel to that. And I wonder, is that part of the process of when you're trying to transfer poetry into music? I know they're not unrelated art forms, but it's a different thing you're looking for. Is it about atmosphere? Is it about feeling?
Yeah, well, I suppose there's, as well, because there's text involved, that there's going to be plenty of space for the written words or the spoken words to resound over. So this will be a performance with Brítanie Nachtan as Danu. And
And Mo Dunford, then, is he going to be the poet arriving on the shores?
He'll be Amargin, yeah. That's the plan.
Film scores and things like that, I suppose, have been the mainstay of the last period of time because of the no live gigs. Is there a kind of a, you know, you were talking about the COVID anxiety earlier on, the social skills. Is there a real thing of, it's quite nice to be wrapped up in your own little studio, doing your own little thing, not having to worry too much about others?
For sure. I mean, haven't spent kind of all of my adult life in vans and buses and, you know, various ramblings. It's been pleasant to stay in one place and to, but I think I've been kind of the, my Venn diagram has been moving heavily towards the kind of sitting still and writing music and recording, and I've been enjoying that more. But I mean, you do miss the trips abroad and the unseasonal sun that comes with it occasionally.
Although you will be heading over to Bethlehem again recently. I know you spoke to me previously about the project, about working with Colin McCann on his projects in the Middle East with Palestinian and Israeli children. And you're working on something on his novel, A Paragon.
Yes, it's kind of inspired. I think that's going to be my next record. So it's music inspired by a novel and a trip to Palestine and Israel and experiencing things there. And so it's I'm kind of looking forward to getting that. So I'm going to go back to there's an artist retreat in Bethlehem, Emily Jasser is based there, and I'm going to go back there and then spend some time in the Centre Culturel Irlandaise in Paris.
Very nice.
Next year.
I'm always afraid to ask people about what about such and such a gig that might or might not happen. When do you think the Frames would get to actually celebrate their 30th anniversary?
Well, I think it might be 33, as they say. next year, I think, will be Kilmainham. It's been put back until May or June. And there is a chance we may be in the United States in September. That's kind of yet to be confirmed or denied. But there's a gig in New York, Chicago, and a couple of gigs in LA as well.
All right. You're going to finish up with a piece called The Finish Line, but it's a finish line with two ends.
It is, yeah.
To do with Finland.
It was about being terribly on tour and homesick, and the finish line appeared.
Yeah. Was it on a train?
It was actually Helsinki. So, yeah, so it was very, very jet-lagged in Helsinki.
Yeah, because there's a real sound of travel in this and lots of loops. Now, you were talking about COVID anxiety. I'm wondering how much performance anxiety you get around these loops. So, sorry for giving you that just before you go to play it.
Oh, I'm very familiar with it. Yeah, the muscle memory and everything has been... I've had to train it all. Yeah, so it's kind of a... It's a strange thing. Sure, yeah. We'll see.
Yeah, it's like a little bit of choreography. You record a little bit, hit the pedal and off you go and do the other bit on top of it. We'll see how it goes.
Yes,
hopefully it'll all
fingers
work.
Fingers crossed.
Great to speak with you, Colin.
Likewise.
Colin McInamara, Catherine Fitzgerald accompanying him here with The Finish Line. Finish Line, performed there by Colin McInamara on fiddle, Catherine Fitzgerald on piano. What a joy it is to sit opposite some music rather than watch it be performed on a screen. Colin McInamara's gig at the Carja Sligo Arts Festival with Maya Sophia. The actual live gig, unfortunately, is sold out, but you can buy a ticket to watch it on the live stream this Saturday at 8 p.m. You can find out full details on carjafestival.com. Traditionally, as part of the Errigal Arts Festival, Donegal's Henry Sisters host a week-long residency which explores songwriting, harmonies, arranging and normally includes tours around the local area and visiting music sessions in local pubs. This year, however, the residency, like so many things, is online. Participants can join in from anywhere around the world. That's the upside, isn't it? And while disappointed not to be able to host the annual physical residential event, the Henry girls still hope to create a memorable experience, and I've no doubt that they will. will. Joining me now, Lorna McLaughlin from the Henry Girls to tell us more. It's been there for a number of years, really, this residency, Lorna. What are the basic idea behind the residency in the first place? What was it?
Hi, Sean. Yeah, we began the residency in 2017, and I think it sort of came from the fact that, you know, we were touring a lot and we were, you know, we're very, you know, from a very beautiful part of Donegal. Mm. We used to always say to people, oh, you should come and visit. And then the Errigal Arts Festival actually proposed this idea that we would create a sort of a residency that we could invite people to. So we were just delighted because then it gave us, you know, something to invite people to come to and enjoy the area.
And show it off. Show it up. Show it off is what you wanted to do. And it was. Exactly. I know that the online event is, I think it's 10 to 2 every day for the Monday to through to Friday. Was the residency something similar? You kind of did a half a day and then there might have been sessions or whatever later in the evening in the pubs and places around the area.
Yeah. When we were here in Malin, it was just, you know, very much meeting in the morning, having your workshop, then having, you know, some nice coffee and cakes that were made by a local chef called Jennifer Doherty. And then we would just do more in the afternoon. And then in the evenings, we might go off on a tour around and then we'd find ourselves up in the local pub in the evening having a music session.
Yeah, so translating then that into an online event, I guess you'll be concentrating on what would have been the morning workshops. That's where you're going to be.
Yes, we're going to be on from 10 till 2. And, you know, I suppose for me, I gained confidence in what's possible online from the fact that I'm a lecturer. I work at a college in Dublin called BIM. And because of COVID and the restrictions and everything, obviously we had to go online for the whole year. And I was just absolutely amazed at the quality of how you can work with people in that setting and how you can still have a really good connection with people. And, you know, you can get lots of good work done. So then, you know, when Errigal came to us and proposed doing it online, I said, well, you know, it worked well for me all year online. So I don't see why we can't create something special online for the residency as well.
Online from Iceland, in fact, if I'm not mistaken, for your BAMM lectures.
Yeah, I mean, I have a sister up in Iceland, so I relocated up to Reykjavik around about December last year. And I just found that life up there was good, given, you know, how the restrictions in Ireland, you know, everything was very locked down. But in Iceland, it's a much smaller population and they seem to have COVID kind of more or less under control. So things were a lot more opened up there. I really loved being up there. It was fantastic.
Is it Jolene that's living up there?
It's another sister who's not in the band, and her name is Maureen.
Oh, right, okay. So, because I mentioned Jolene, because Jolene, she's not a sister, Anise, who's not in the band just yet. Jolene had a little girl recently, did she?
Yeah, Jolene had a little girl in November, a little girl called Sarah. Yeah, so that was our great happy news from last year.
I hope Sarah can sing harmonies, because she's going to be anywhere near the Henry Girls. She's going to have to be able to do that, isn't she?
Oh, yeah, she loves music. Like, she's, you know, it's lovely to have her there whenever we're sitting around, you know, practicing and just, she really enjoys it, you can tell.
All right. Well, listen, we'll finish up by listening to you and those harmonies very much to the fore. Tell me a little bit about Sing My Sister Down before I play it, if you would, Lorna.
Well, this is one of our older songs. I think we recorded this one around 10 years ago, and it's just about, well, you know, we're from a big family of sisters. There's 6 of us all together, and it was based on a short story that Karen read, and the title was actually called Singing My Sister Down. So it's just basically about sisters being there for each other.
All right, well, fair enough. Whether that's in Iceland or up in Malin, you're going to be there for each other at any rate. I'll give full details out, Lorna, at the end of this as to how people can find out more about the actual workshops themselves. But thanks for being with us this evening. And enjoy.
Thanks so much, Sean.
Enjoy lovely Donegal and being able to do your workshop from home over the next while. Here we have, not at all, the Henry Girls and Sing My Sister Down. Beautiful harm. harmony and music there from the Henry Girls. Lorna McLaughlin speaking to us earlier on. The name of that title of that song, by the way, is Sing My Sister Down. But the workshops that Lorna was telling us about, Home From Home is the title of those workshops, begins this Monday, 12th of July, continues through until Friday the 16th as part of the Errigal Arts Festival. You can find out full details of that. Everything happening at the festival, in fact, on the website, EAF, Errigal Arts Festival, EAF.ie. That's our lot for this Thursday evening. Liam Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Jamie Doyle was on sound this evening. Tonight's programme produced by Olin McGough.